Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Fergus Conley is one of the world's leading experts in team sport and human performance. His highly acclaimed book, Game Changer, is the first blueprint for coaches to present a holistic philosophy for winning in all team sports. Fergus is the only coach to have worked full-time in every major league around the world. He helps teams win at the highest level with the integrated application of best practices in all areas of performance. Fergus has served as Director of Elite Performance for the San Francisco 49ers, Sports Science Director with the Welsh Rugby Union, and Performance Director for the University of Michigan Football. His most recent book is called 59 Lessons.
Coach, it's awesome to have Fergus Conley here. Fergus, let's start with this concept, because for those that haven't read Game Changers, by the way, you should. It's a tremendous resource for coaches. Can you explain what you mean by evidence-based analysis and athlete-focused training? Let's start with evidence-based analysis.
Yeah, so this all started because I would, you know, with different teams, didn't matter whether it was rugby, soccer, football, basketball, you know, after post games, we had all of these stats reports and you had wonderful analysts and, you know, data people, and some of them were kids who were just so enthusiastic about producing numbers and brilliant reports. But over time, you start to realize there's a lot of this data that actually doesn't help us improve the performance of the players, doesn't help us impact practice, and certainly isn't helping us impact the next game that we're preparing for. And that's where, you know, I started to look at, okay, well, what data is actually useful? What's the context? And one of the very first books that caught my attention was Soccernomics, and it was looking at taking data and looking at it. And I remember reaching out to Simon Cooper, one of the authors, and, you know, he subsequently interviewed me afterwards, because I made the point to him that when he was looking at numbers like tackles, that's not perhaps a useful metric, because it's showing you that you're actually out of possession, that you're working hard, yes, tackling, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're playing better. So evidence-based analysis is really about looking at the data in context and intelligently, so that you can impact practice and impact future results, rather than just taking numbers that are being produced randomly. And then how do we look at this? How do we recreate drills or games or experiences for the player in practice going forward that are going to improve that player? And that's the goal. You know, the goal is obviously to win the next game.
So one thing that I love that I have taken into context in everything that I do that you've said is collecting data shouldn't start with what you can gather. Because, I mean, I've been around some pro teams that I cannot imagine what they even do with the amount of data they collect. Can you explain this concept?
Yes. There is a mindset in Western culture of, you know, more is better. So let's collect as much as possible, or, you know, the more data we have, the better the decision we're going to make, or we have access to this, let's collect it. And that really distracts us from the quality and from the main focus. And with analysis and with data, there's a rush to, you know, collect as much information as possible, and it all must be useful. And really the opposite is the case. The biggest mistake that we make in sport is not finding solutions. The biggest mistake we make in sport is we don't identify the problem correctly. And the only way to identify the problem is to look at the game, to really diagnose what went right, what went wrong, and then go and say, okay, what data do we need to solve this problem? Most teams, most organizations have a different approach. They go, let's collect all of this data and let's look at the numbers that are outliers or that appear to be wrong, and that must be the problem. And that's a huge mistake. You never actually get to the problem. So identifying the problem correctly should be the biggest challenge. or should be the main focus. And that's what the best coaches do. They identify the correct source of the problem, and then they go, okay, how can we fix that? Is there data that can help us? And if there isn't data, well, then we'll do it subjectively. But if there is data, that's going to provide great insight for us. So it's really about, okay, let's figure out what the real problem here is. Like, why are we making this mistake? Why does it happen late in the game? Or why is it happening early in the game? Why is it only happening on this side of the field or this side of the court? Why is this player only doing it? Rather than just taking all of the data that we can potentially gather. And you see, you often see it in new backroom teams when they start as well. One of the other mistakes is, particularly with sports science or data analysis, is, okay, let's just collect all the data we can for a year or two, and then we'll start, you know, in year two, year three, that's when we really get insight, which is, you know, which is actually backwards. No, let's look at problems. Let's, you are a problem solver as a coach. That's really what you are. That requires critical thinking. It requires an ability to fail fast. It's just a completely different mindset to what we've become accustomed to, you know, in the West, where we have all of this data available.
Well, I love that. And, you know, when you said problem solver, that obviously triggers me too, because in the best situation, players and athletes are problem solvers as well. And that comes to this next part, which is athlete-focused training. What does that mean for you?
Yeah, so that's a brilliant point. And I was making that very same argument to somebody recently, to a coach recently, where a player in a split moment of a game, when they collect a ball or they pass a ball, they are solving problems immediately in their brain. You know, what side is this ball coming to? Where are the players? Where are my teammates? Where am I on the court? What's the, like, so it's a, their brain is this mini processor that's processing all of this information and solving problems at an enormously fast rate. And our goal should be to encourage that, to train instinct in the player. And obviously you're trying to create the correct instinct. You're trying to inspire the player to learn, not to be overly stressed, so they can make clear decisions. So that's in a game scenario. In practice, we have to recreate the same scenarios. We have to, okay, identify that the player, perhaps when they receive a ball in this particular context or situation, they could make better decisions. Okay, how do I create that same scenario in practice with less pressure? Help them recreate and make the correct decision, and then continue to reinforce that so that on the court, it becomes automatic. That's the real goal of, you know, of practice, is to improve the player as a decision maker. You know, it could be to do with skill, it could be to do with managing their energy, it could be to do with, you know, guarding someone, whatever it is, that's whatever that problem, that challenge is, that's what we're trying to create in practice.
Such a fan of that concept, and you know, I think it's just so valuable and such a missing piece for so many coaches that can be more effective with that. And then leading into that is, what are some of the big gaps you've seen with effective coaches? Like, what are some of the gaps that they can fill to be more effective?
So if you look at any practice script, you know, for any team, and you were to be brutally honest as a coaching staff and just sat down and looked at it and went, okay, how much of this are we just doing because we've done it every other day? How many of these drills in particular are mindless? And, you know, I use the visual or the image of, look, coach, if we could take every player's brain out and just leave it on the side of the court, like, how many of these drills could they do without thinking? And you'd want the player to be actively engaged, concentrating, building an instinct, having an experience in as many drills and games, small-sided games or scenarios as possible. And when you look at scripts often, there's a large portion of practice where there's no thinking required. Players go through they go through the motions. Well, that's for the most part, apart from, you know, the warm-up and some of those other routines, it's mindless. It's not helping the player improve. And in some cases, actually, you're just reinforcing poor habits. And so, you know, look at your practice script and go, okay, which of these drills or small-sided games, tactical games, technical games, are we creating that are really helping the player improve? And it is challenging for coaches. You know, it does. It takes work. But that is the best way to improve a player and to not reinforce poor habits.
So, you know, from a basketball coach's perspective, if I'm phrasing this for coaches, we're talking about a lot of these perfection drills, like these drills we do daily, and we're looking for our athletes to be perfect. And we know there's no learning in that scenario, right? You've already explained that. So I'm wondering if you could just speak to those coaches a little bit and talk, because there is value to some comfort and confidence building, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it depends on the level as well. You know, it definitely depends on the level of athlete. So for example, at the pro level, you know, players will come in and they need to go through a certain routine to raise heart rate, to get warmed up, and to, you know, and it's not about stressing players also. You want them to feel comfortable, to have some banter and enjoyment. Now, from the coaching perspective, you're watching them all the time because you're wanting to see what their movement pattern is. Are they moving smoothly? Are they a little bit stiff? Are they tired? So this is it's almost like a movement screen, because you're watching the players and you're just seeing what their humor, what their mood is, how hard will I push them today? And then as you start to transition to the main practice, that's when you want to put the players, like I say, in situations or stress them so that they're improving all of the time. So it's how you look at it. And there is value in some routine, but just make sure that it's not, you know, that the largest part of your practice is not actually challenging the players.
And I just wanted to bring those two things together, because obviously there is a balance to it, but by and large, the balance is skewed towards too much mindless. Is that fair to say that most coaches are probably still in that area of too much mindless? And I imagine the reason of beyond cultural norms and kind of historical norms, what they were taught, what they know, is for them, it builds confidence too, because they feel like players are doing well in practice because they're not making mistakes.
Yes. And also there's a certain amount of comfort in, look, that, you know, we're going to go through this and, it's easier to compare a player, you know, in a very, very simple drill, it's very easy to spot mistakes. But the problem is that that's not what's going to face them in a game scenario. You know, the game itself has so many different variables that we need to take into account. So I can see why we do it, but there's, you know, is it challenging the player? Is it making, are we really bringing the player out of their comfort zone just a little bit each time? That's where they start to improve. It's at that edge. And the other thing is, we can't, put the player under excessive stress and pressure all of the time. So there is, you know, room, there is the opportunity to, in between those little blocks of high concentration, to put in a little bit of a routine where the players can go through the motions there. You take that mental pressure off them, and then you go back into another, you know, small game, small drill that is putting them under a lot of pressure. And that's how you enforce the quality of the experience. If we think of it very much from the player psychologically, in terms of what is the experience I'm trying to stress or put the player under, that's where the value is.
Well, I love that you keep using the word experience, because that's such an important part of the learning process, this experiential learning. And if we don't put players in these experiences that they're going to experience in a game in practice, then they're not going to transfer and they're not going to connect the ideas we're trying to go through well. So it's just tremendous. And I'm wondering, as we're speaking to mainly team sport coaches on this podcast, are there any trends in successful sport practice training for team sports that you can highlight for coaches?
Well, so one of the ironies is that teams that are very successful, and before we came on air, I mentioned two NBA teams that I worked with recently, but one of them is particularly successful and has some of the world's best players. they, ironically, because they're playing games at such a high level and everybody raises their game to play against them in the NBA, the experience of that elite player, those elite players, is of such a high quality. They're actually making that those superstars better every week. And so the best practice is the game. Now, the downside is they're a little bit more fatigued early, you know, post-game, and it drains more of them. The irony is they have to practice less. So from look at the total week, that team that everybody raises their game to play, plays at a higher level than, you know, than normal. Everybody wants to beat them. But they're actually, that team's becoming better and better because they're, that maximum experience of those players is at such a high quality. So the irony is, the better you are, the more rich the game experience is, the less you practice, the less you can practice, you're more fatigued. And that's a good thing because the quality practice comes in the games, you know, week after week or game after game after game. And so the lesson for other teams or for lower level teams is the quality of the game and the quality of the practice must be as high as possible. The quality must be as high as possible and maybe have less, you know, or have more downtime and more rest time. You cannot, it's the quality, the richness of the quality is what's going to make your team better week in, week out.
Great, great, great stuff.
And this was, the first place I realized this was with the Bulls, you know, speaking to the coaches at the Bulls with Jordan and Pippen and these guys, because I was fascinated by, okay, how do you keep playing at such a high level? Like, what, how do you practice so well? You know, because you've got these long seasons, you're in the playoffs, you seem to peak. And that was when, you know, the guys are going, we don't practice as hard as you think we practice. The game is actually what's making us better. And so the irony was, I was thinking, okay, well, you know, to play and to actually start to peak going into the playoffs, well, you must be training really, really hard. And that must be, you know, no, we don't have to, because every team that wants to play us is trying to push us harder. So we actually rest and recover more than anybody else because the quality of performance is actually our best practice.
I'm curious, I guess, since we have your expertise, to kind of start kind of from the beginning of practice, because again, I get asked a lot of these questions and I think there's still a lot of mythology behind what is a warm-up and what's the best process of getting yourself ready for practice. What constitutes a warm-up, and then you know, what are some things that maybe coaches haven't thought about? Because by and large, I find most basketball coaching practices warming up the same way they did 10, 20 years ago. Is there anything new that we should be thinking about or anything we should be doing?
Well, so, you know, I'm a huge fan of working backwards. Like, I mean, the outcome at the end of a warm-up is that you want, you know, the players to have gone through a series of, you know, movements so that their whole musculature mechanically is familiar with the positions that it's going to go through, so that, you know, you're talking about full range of motion and through most of the joints. So that's the first thing. Secondly, then you want blood flow, you want heart rate raised. And then thirdly, you want nervous system switched on. Now, then you decide, okay, well, what is the pathway? What is the transition that I'm going to go through? So you can use drills, you can use games. So like starting out, you would start generally with, you know, ideally stationary, you know, just passing ball, throwing a ball, and then, you know, transition to very short movements. And whatever that might be, whether it's small games, whether it's, you know, small game scenarios where you can actually put the players through that and they start to elevate their heart rate and all of those different things. If you can do that, I don't really care what the movement is. But now, from the coaching perspective, that is a screen for you. It's almost like, it's basically like an MOT, like a checkup, where you're just watching the players, because what you're looking for is you want to see which players maybe are not as energetic, which players need a longer warm-up, which players maybe are very excited, very hyped, and we need to just pull them back. So this is so that that's what you're looking for in those things, you know, in the activities that they perform. Like, are they a little bit tight? And again, biomechanically, this is just, you know, when I see players move, you know, I'm looking at hips, ankle, knees. Is low back stiff or shoulders tight? Like that's what I see. And then that just gives me feedback as to, okay, you know what? Guys are moving just a little bit stiff and sore today. Let's lengthen the warm up a little bit more, or with the early drills, let's just take our time as the guys start to get going. Let's not push it too hard. That's where the value is for that.
So we don't necessarily have to do dynamic type of A, B's and C's track type movements. We can get into basketball specific movements to start with.
Absolutely. And this is, and one of the things too, again, it depends on the level, but like, I mean, if with professional athletes, because they've been moving so much, you know, this is what they do. Now, if players have had a longer layoff, yes, maybe you might start with very, very simple rudiment movements. You might do that if, you know, if they've been off for a while, but you don't have to start with, you know, A drills, B drills. That's just taking, you know, track stuff and just putting it onto the court, which, you know, yeah, okay. It's, again, this is where, oh, it's very safe and it's very secure. So that's why we're going to do it. But these are basketball players who've been playing basketball all their life. They know how to move. But you do have to ensure that they're getting, you know, full range of motion at some stage in the warm up, so that they're prepared then to transition into, you know, medium intensity, then higher intensity exercise as the practice goes on.
Well, I love that. And like for me, this relates to all my philosophy of practice, which is specificity of training. Like, there's nothing more specific than playing basketball if I'm trying to develop my players, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I remember going to practice, soccer practice way back, you know, my first job in the Premier League. And I would go out and the guys are out on the field already and they're just kicking a ball around. And then we had an older coach came along and he put up volleyball courts, like a volleyball net. And so the players, without any encouragement at all, the following day they're out, they're kicking a ball around between themselves, they're talking, they're chatting. Then some of them jog over to the volleyball net and they're kicking the ball over and back. They're playing volleyball with their feet. And this goes on for 10, 20 minutes before practice actually starts. Well, the players have warmed up. Nobody has brought them over, sat them down and done a, you know, gone through track movements and drills and all of this, you know, stationary rudiment movement before they've gone and kicked. So they've warmed themselves up. And so long, and the volleyball activity was ingenious because the space was limited. So while they're kicking a ball over and back gently and having a bit of banter and a bit of fun over and back across a net, the space is confined. So there's no big jump sprints or lunges that are going to strain a muscle. It was all just light movement, tapping a ball over and back. That's how, you know, a soccer player might warm up on grass, and then you can transition through to, okay, just raising the heart rate now. And one of the things that did one NFL team was they would do the warm-ups similarly in a confined space with small groups where guys are throwing a basketball back and forth among themselves. So they can't, again, if the space is restricted, they're not going to have any of these dramatic dynamic lunges. And they're warming up with the upper body to start with. Then you widen the space. They keep doing the same simple activity. And now there's a little bit more lateral movement. Steps are a little bit bigger. And then you just, every, you know, minute or two, just blow the whistle and go, hey, guys, just give me a calf stretch. They all go down to a calf stretch and they get back up and they just go back into the movement. And it's all low level, fun warm up. The guys are just playing a game. They're doing... And they're far more engaged, but more importantly, you're developing things like peripheral vision. You're developing awareness, proprioception in a fun way. And look, at the end of the day, they all started to play this game because it was a game and it was fun. And we need to, you know, I'm a huge fan of, in anything we do, put the fun back into it from the warm-up the whole way through, because that's why we started playing this game.
I love that example. It's such a great example. And you know, I guess the main point, again, we don't have to formalize the warm-up like that. We can play basketball to warm up, because we have to remove fluff, because we need to get right to the point and not waste this time. And again, I just find coaches don't take advantage of some really important times to be able to develop players, because they're doing fluff that doesn't happen in the game. The other point I want to quickly ask you about with this is, often we look to the pros to be able to learn what the best practices are. But isn't it somewhat fair that a lot of the professional teams or coaches are less likely to be on the cutting edge and less likely to change because there's so much money on the line? They're going to traditionally go back to what they've done because there's less incentive to change, because I'm already making money and I want to keep this job preservation. Is that fair?
Oh man, you're trying to do me out of work here.
No, it's a generalization, so that's unfair. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I think there's so many coaches that do a really great job, but we kind of dismiss it because, oh, they're not a pro coach, or they're not a celebrity coach, or, you know, even some cases they're not winning.
No, you're absolutely right. Some of the most ingenious coaches I've seen are at high school level, because they create environments naturally for players that have fun. They enjoy it. They're far more aware of the personality of the player. But at the pro level, there are so many other restrictions, you know, not least the CBA, but also, you know, in professional basketball in particular, because there are so many other people involved in the player's life, it's harder to influence the player. So it becomes more about managing the personality, getting the player on side. The other point as well about the pro is that by the time they've got to that level, they've been playing basketball for a long, long time. You know, they've got habits, instincts, intuition already established. And so really it's about managing this, you know, beautiful, magnificent athlete or player. And so it requires a different style of management and a completely different mindset and a completely different psychology. And it's something that, you know, particularly over the last 12, 18 months that I've spent a lot more time on focusing on, is at that tier one, at that elite level, that is a completely different person, professional as well, that you need to manage. So when you go and observe professional practice, you have to recognize that it's completely different to what might be happening at high school. There's a completely different requirement. Yes, they're playing the same sport. Yes, they have the same origin, but it's a completely different person. So, I think that sitting down talking with, you know, peers, coaches, high school coaches, you know, how would you encourage this player to have this experience, or this group of players, or what do they need? I think, you know, you come across some incredibly bright coaches. And one other point I will make as well is, now at this point in time, we have professional coaches. In other words, we have coaches who have only ever coached basketball. We have coaches who have only ever maybe played the game, then transitioned into basketball. And this is a relatively new phenomenon. It's not that long ago that all of the successful coaches that we had started out as teachers, started out as mailmen, started out as, you know, bar owners, whatever. And so they brought with them an experience of dealing with people, of managing people, that really served them well in dealing with the person that they were coaching in the sport. And if you go back to all of the great coaches that, you know, from a football perspective, the Lombardis, the Walshes, all of these, they didn't start as coaches. And I think that there is a lot to be learned and a lot to add value to coaching from outside of coaching in terms of dealing with the person, because we're dealing with a person who plays a sport. We're not dealing with just a, you know, professional athlete. And the best coaches appear to be, whether it's the Popoviches, the Kerrs, whatever, they seem to be the best at dealing with the person who plays the sport. And I think that's where a lot of untapped value can be added in basketball today.
So you answered that great. Probably I should have asked that better, because that's what I was getting at, that they're far different players, can't necessarily extrapolate what a pro coach or, you know, a high level, as we're talking about basketball, high level NCAA one coach, what they deal with versus what we deal with, say, at lower levels or certainly at youth levels, high school level. So that's awesome.
Yeah, and you've seen it as well. Like, I mean, you know, you've been a pro practice and you see something being done, but you know the context, like, you know why they're doing it. Whereas if somebody else didn't and just saw that one drill and said, oh, I got to do that drill when I go back to my high school, unless you know the context and the reason behind it, that's the value. So, you know, I say to coaches all the time, you know, ask why, go three levels deep. So that when you understand the why, then you understand what, you know, what they're actually doing and what the reason behind the what. That's the important thing. And again, back to the context, you know, at the pro level, completely different context, maybe to college or to high school. And one other thing, just societally as well, we have young kids now who from high school come into this system, if you will. You know, they're in a basketball system, and that's, you know, they're it's not as structured per se, but they're playing basketball from high school, college, pro. That's a long apprenticeship. It's a long journey. And so recognizing that, you know, we need to develop the person as fast and as well as we're developing the player for them to sustain success. That's a really, really important challenge, I think, for coaches now. It's not just about developing the player, it's about developing the person.
So we talked about warm-up. Let's talk about post-practice and recovery. Some of the best practices coaches should be thinking about. And again, usually just practice ends and that's it. And, you know, players move on and different things like that. And you see that all the time. But, you know, from a physiological and psychological perspective, can you give us some ideas for post-practice?
Yeah, a lot of it is determined by travel and restrictions and what you can do. So in many cases, we can't actually do it. You know, like in the pros, guys would just get finished on a bus and on a plane. Now, ideally, you would have some small movement. You would warm down. You would encourage blood flow and circulation so that the body, you know, begins to process. And there's more and more information coming out about spinal fluid and about how the brain itself essentially washes itself free. And that's a whole other conversation related to brain injury, CTE, and all of those things. But ideally, you have some form of a cool down where players gradually recover over time and you facilitate the recovery. I'm not a huge fan of forcing recovery. I think that takes time. Psychologically, there's a great opportunity to sit down and review what went well, what didn't. And the best process that I found is having a short, you call it a hot wash or an after action review, where immediately after practice, coaches have a brief conversation about what went well, what didn't. The coaching staff then just as a group have a brief conversation with the players to get their feedback and, you know, to give them some feedback to, and it's very brief, emotions taken out of it. And then the following day or after at the next practice, that's when you have the cold wash where, you know, you both have had an opportunity to sit down, look at it in the cold light of day and go, okay, this is what we did really, really well, guys. This is what we can improve on. And then this is what our, you know, our practice is going to look like to improve the things that we can improve on and to reinforce the things we did really well. So just viewing it as a two-stage, you know, recovery, and also recognizing that there is a tactical, psychological aspect to recovery, not just purely, you know, physical alone.
This is the time traditionally some coaches would go to static stretching. Is that still valid or?
Yes, you can do...
Say in a practice setting, not a game setting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in a practice setting, it can be helpful. But actually, what is more useful is if you can develop a habit, a culture where players will do a little bit more static stretching later on in the evening on their own, that would be really, really helpful if you can do that. But that takes a little bit of time to build that culture in where players, when they go home in the evening, maybe the last thing they do before bed are just a series of static stretches just to switch off the nervous system, help them unwind. But that will you. The best way to do that is create it as part of like a sleep prep routine, where players go, okay, I'm going to turn off my phone, I'm going to turn off my iPad, I'm going to leave them in the room next to me. I'm going to go for a brief 20-minute walk outside in fresh air. I'm going to do a little bit of stretching, you know, even as I walk or when I get back, and then I'm going to go to bed, get a good night's sleep. If you can create it as part of a routine, then it doesn't become standalone, and it actually has a better stickability, if you will, or has a better chance of becoming a habit that sustains the player's success over long term.
I like it. I like giving some guidance to coaches on some of those areas that maybe don't get enough attention when we basketball coaches get together in particular. So
I had a pro rugby player who had serious trouble sleeping, and gave him three things to do it. And part of it was stretching, you know, at whatever time he was going to go to bed. And I said, okay, 30 minutes beforehand, I want you to pick, you know, four stretches that you'll do. Turn off your phone, turn off the TV, turn everything, go for a 20-minute walk in the fresh air, come back and just go to bed. And I think it was 2 weeks later, he called me, and he couldn't have been more grateful for just those few small things that actually helped him begin to sleep better than he had slept for, actually it was years in his case. And he was a great guy. He just was overthinking some things, and that was just, but making it as part of a routine made it more stickable than just giving him a one-off thing to do.
Hey coach, just a brief interruption from the podcast to hear from one of our supporters, LinkedIn. The perfect hire can have an impact on your business for years to come. So when you need to find that next person to help grow your business, LinkedIn Jobs will match the right talent with your open role fast. I personally use LinkedIn, and I know many of you in the coaching profession do too. Did you know LinkedIn has over 675 million members worldwide? LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills you're looking for, so you can hire the right person fast. Things like collaboration, creativity, adaptability. LinkedIn looks beyond the work skills and puts your job post in front of qualified candidates who match your business requirements perfectly. That's how LinkedIn makes sure your job post is seen by the people you want to hire, people with the skills, qualifications, and other interests that will help your business grow. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds with LinkedIn. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first 50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/team. Again, that's linkedin.com/team to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. With home security, there's two ways you can go about protecting your home. There's the traditional way, where you wait weeks for a technician to do a messy installation that costs a small fortune. Or there's the other way, SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe is everything you need in a home security system. It's award-winning protection, two-time winner of CNET Editor's Choice Award. SimpliSafe blankets your whole home in safety. You get comprehensive protection for your entire home. Outdoor cameras and doorbells alert you to anyone approaching your home. Entry, motion, and glass break sensors guard inside. You barely notice it's there. But what's truly remarkable is you can set up this system all by yourself. Anyone can do it. It takes 30 minutes to an hour tops, and there's absolutely no trade-offs to your safety. You'll have an army of highly trained security experts ready to dispatch police to your home at a moment's notice 24/7. And it's only 50 cents a day with no contracts. It's why The Verge calls SimpliSafe the best home security system. Go to simplisafe.com/team today, and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplisafe.com/team. That's simplisafe.com/team.
Great. Yeah, really good example too, that coaches can find their own way of applying. But I really like that. So moving maybe now to a little bit of off-season focus for coaches. Where do they start with building a player development program? I know that's a broad question, but let's say a high school coach that, you know, doesn't have the resources to do all the testing, et cetera. Where do they start with the player development program?
Yeah, so I actually find that many of the coaches who have less technology actually produce better players because they don't get caught up in this race for numbers, and they don't get blinded by all of this test set. This, you know, I start with a very, very simple looking at the player tactically, technically, physically, psychologically, and just going through. And it starts with a very simple spreadsheet, every player's name down the left-hand side of the page, those four columns, and just sitting down, if they're on their own or doing it with another coach, and just writing, you know, a sentence underneath, alongside each player, you know, tactically, what is the biggest area of improvement for this player tactically? What's the biggest area, you know, physically or psychologically? And just short comments, and then identifying, okay, what's the trend here for the team as a whole? So, for example, if the majority of the players appear to have an issue with, for example, physicality or strength, okay, well, that's a theme for the team as a whole. And now we can ensure that our practice largely incorporates more either drills or games that encourage the development of the player physically, maybe some body weight exercise or weight training, whatever. But identify the theme for the team as a whole. Now, the one proviso is, if you're having that conversation with another coach, you must do it with film. It's not good enough to say, oh, he's not fast, or he's not strong, or he can't pass off his left side, or he's very poor. You have to show evidence of film, because sometimes we create, even the best coaches, we have our own biases that misinform us with our best intention. So sitting in a room, watching film with that sheet and just going through each player and have one point, and then going, okay, these are the elements for each player. There's only four categories. This is what we're going to work on to develop this player's limiting factor. The one thing maybe that if we improve it, these other things are going to improve. And just keep it very, very simple. And film, you know, you can test metrics all you want, but you cannot beat film. Film is undefeated, because that's the evidence. That's the true evidence, you know, of how we're performing day to day.
So that's awesome that you said that. And I was going to bring that up, because for me, like, I used to start off kind of following the textbook and producing this massive document to prepare a player for their offseason program, et cetera, et cetera. And then as I gradually got going, this isn't helping as much as me providing them 3 to 4 clips of very specific things that I'm saying, okay, here's what I feel you can improve. And look, here's the evidence or the example. And then also to be able to explain to them, this is improvable. Like, I wouldn't show them something that they can't improve. So I found those 3 to 4 clips to be the most effective kind of starting point. So I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, and actually, you raised a really good point. You know, that yes, bring the player in. And what you'll find sometimes is when you present to a player and say, look, I've noticed this trend you're doing, you know, this is something that we can improve on. A better way to improve it is, this is what I think, you know, or this is what I see. What do you see? Don't present it as an absolute. Don't say, this is what you're doing wrong. This is what we present it as, this is what I'm seeing. Do you see, or what do you see? That's the window where the player can say to you, you know, in a safe environment, well, coach, to be really honest, the reason that I'm doing that is because I'm scared to do this, or I know that I can't go this way, or I'm, you know, every time I go to my right, that's when I seem to lose the ball. And that can provide that just little bit of insight into realizing it's actually that he can't do it. It's that he's scared of doing it because of something that happened, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe another coach shouted at him, or whatever it might be, or he has a perception that he can't do it. So that moment of conversation between you and the player sometimes can provide an insight that is very eye-opening and very, very helpful for you going forward.
Tremendous. So I guess the other danger, I think, nowadays is because there is so much information online that it's too easy to be too creative with workouts. Is that a real thing? Is that something that we should be worried about a little bit?
I think we're all, like, I mean, I've been guilty of it too, you know, particularly when I was starting out, you know, I would practice and then maybe, you know, the night before I'm reading something or I see something, I go, oh man, I got to put that drill in. That's, you know, that's brilliant. Without just really, and I had a coach one time who, you know, told me one of the best pieces of advice he gave me was, look, don't undervalue your own experience and the learning that you're getting from practice, you know, and sometimes just simply reflecting on what we're doing and that learning opportunity. So yes, you know, learn from whoever you can, choose your mentors wisely, but also reflect on your own practice, reflect on what you did, reflect on what you're going to do as much as you can, because there's a lot of value in that as well. So there's a balance. You want to be creative. You don't want to be stagnant. You don't add too much. But at the end of the day, it's really about working backwards, work backwards from the game and work backwards from your desired outcome. That's the best advice that I can give.
Well, I love that, because working backwards to me comes back to these two questions, which I always ask. Is it helping the player improve? And is it helping our team ultimately win in the team context? And I always come back to those two things. If we're doing something that isn't doing one of those things, why are we doing it? It's just fluff.
Yeah. Does it affect the scoreboard? Is it going to affect the scoreboard? And I'm not saying that absolutely everything needs to be ruthless, but it's a very good starting point. You know, you want the majority of your practice to be focused and dedicated towards making the team player better every time.
Well, and the part for a player to be able to improve is also to be able to enjoy the game more. I'm talking about development. I mean, we're talking about a player enjoying the game more, right?
I can't stress that enough, because, you know, even with one of the biggest impediments to improvement is stress and pressure, where players are under an excessive amount of pressure and stress. They don't feel as though they can make mistakes. They can't. They're afraid to go up to that edge where they're a little bit uncomfortable. And so they're just going to keep doing the same things they've always done, because that's what they're secure in. And that's where laughter, banter, teasing in a good-natured way, those things reduce the pressure, allow players to enjoy it more. They're going to have more fun. They're going to learn more. They're going to be more positive. They're going to be more resilient. And they're going to bounce back from, you know, losses and mistakes or whatever. And so just sometimes being too serious about practice and about games, just keeping that balance so that it is fun. Like I said, we all started in this field because it was fun and enjoyable, and, you know, we shouldn't lose that.
And then staying on development a little bit, is there a stage in the development process, or even, you know, a different thing, whether it's sports psych or recovery or something like that, some modality, so to speak, that we as coaches have a complete blind spot to, that you've noticed that we need to spend more time on or more attention?
Well, possibly. I think one of the ones that I think we forget about a lot is laughter, and, like, I mean, and humor. I think it's incredibly important, you know, to have some fun and enjoyment in it, because it's a wonderful way to disengage, to distract, to allow people to relax. Because very often we turn up at practice and, you know, it's very serious and it's very focused. But if we focus a lot on the player experience, not the coaching experience so much, but the player experience, like, one of the things I've often encouraged young coaches to do is, as you go into practice tomorrow, view the whole experience from the player's perspective. Like, if you were a player coming into practice, what would your experience be? You know, would it be one that's very serious? Would it be very structured? Would it be fun? Would it be enjoyable? You know, just, you know, take that opportunity to view. And I, this sounds unusual, but I've asked coaches sometimes to actually just visually walk themselves through practice from the player's perspective. Like, I mean, what if I was a player, you know, going through practice, what would my experience be being coached by me? Would I be all inclusive? Would I be too focused? Would I be too, am I someone, like, do, would I see that coach as someone that I could approach to talk to? Am I allowing enough feedback? You know, am I suppressing good leadership? Am I encouraging others that have potential leadership qualities? And that's just taking that time to reflect, have that conversation with other coaches. I think that's particularly important. Sometimes we just focus on what we want to get done all of the time without really considering what is the player's experience of being coached by me.
Well said, well said. And I know that that was a huge problem and a big regret for me as a coach that, I did not, and I mentioned this in another podcast, that I did not show enough enjoyment of actually coaching, because I loved coaching, but I didn't show enough enjoyment. So my players always thought it was a serious, intense environment. That's a big regret.
Yes. Yeah, I've made that mistake myself too. And I it comes with experience as well, because you start to realize, okay, there's a lot of stuff that I'm doing that's actually not that important. You take time, you just take a step back, and that actually makes you a better coach.
Oh, that's great. I guess on the sports psych piece a little bit, mental skills training, what are some practical things? You know, because I find with sports psych, a lot of coaches stay away from it because it seems to be this, bring in a sports psychologist, give a speech, tell us about Red Wagon or something like that, and then leave us on our own. So the problem is integration. So what are some practical things that coaches can integrate in practice when it comes to a little bit of mental skills and sports?
Yeah, so the funny thing about sports psychology is, you know, coaches, you're right, you know, many coaches don't want to go there. And the irony is everything they do has a psychological element. Like, it's omnipresent. You cannot get away from it. Like, I mean, if you...
Without us knowing it, right? Like, we're sports psychologists without us knowing.
Exactly. Everybody's a psychologist to some degree or has a psychological impact, right or wrong. And, you know, with certain organizations I've worked with, you know, we have this conversation that your best psychologist is actually your strength coach in some cases, because they're the ones who spend more time with whatever it might be. So everybody has an opportunity to influence. And I think for the most part, it's about common sense. The best coaches are aware. I can't stress that enough. They're aware, they're present, they pick up on clues. You know, they see the player that needs a little bit of a lift. They see the other player who's getting maybe a little bit carried away, or, you know, who has self-esteem issues, whatever it might be. So it's really about being aware of each of the players. And one of the things I've done with teams, and this is something I've done actually both at the pros and even at high school, is just going through errors or mistakes in film and in a very safe way asking player, okay, psychologically or mentally, and not necessarily using that term, but I'm going, what were you thinking when you did that? And doing it in a humorous way, you know, like that was like something like a caveman would do. And, you know, then having this conversation around, well, what do cavemen do? Do they think things through? And, you know, you get a bit of humor, a bit of laughter. No, they don't. Okay. Well, so what kind of mentality or what kind of approach would you have? Who is a very thoughtful kind of person? Like, why did you react emotionally like that? Why did you not take a moment? And were you not more cool and calm? And then coming up with phrases where things like, you know, we would have catchphrases, keep your head cool, but your feet warm. And just giving them visual cues, catchphrases, quotes that they can relate to. And you don't have to, you know, I don't have to sit down and talk to someone about the forebrain, midbrain, amygdala, and, you know, all of this. I just have to give them visuals that they can understand. Oh, okay, I understand what he's talking about. Feet warm, head cool. Makes sense.
I think team coaches, you know, in particular, like, always have this challenge of balancing individual development with team development. And I say it's all the same to a certain extent in a team practice, because I'm developing individuals to be better within the team concepts. So I'm coaching individuals at the same time. But what are some concepts or some ideas that you share when it comes to balancing individual development with team development?
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that the easiest way to do it in practice is to have like two individual blocks within practice. So 2 5-minute blocks, 5 7-minute blocks where players know in that window, I'm going to go and work on a drill either on my own or with another teammate on this one area that we have both agreed, myself and the coach, that I need to work on. It could be a dribbling drill, shooting drill, movement drill, yarding, whatever it is. So and you can put them in almost as rest periods in between practice where you blow the whistle and go, right, guys, we're working on our individual improvements. And you've got like 4 stations, 5 stations where guys just go. And for that 5 minutes, they just concentrate. Like I said, so if there's a teammate that's working on something similar, they both work together. And it's usually individual, or it could be 2v2 or whatever it is. But for those 5 minutes, we're just working on that one thing. And the player knows, this is my moment now to concentrate on this one thing that I'm going to put in practice, you know, throughout in practice later on. But for these 5 minutes, I'm going to work on it one-on-one or 2v2. And so everybody just scatters to just different parts of the court to just work on these things. It's already been predetermined. But the player knows that I individually am getting better. And then you go back into the normal practice, and then maybe later on, with 10, 15 minutes to go, you blow the whistle again and go, okay, guys, 5 minutes working on our improvements, and you go and do it. That's the best way to do it. But you already have predetermined and spoken with the player about, okay, this is the one thing that I want you to practice on. Or it could be one or two things where, you know, the first break you concentrate on one, the second break you concentrate on the second. Or if it's just one thing that they really need to work on, they do it in both of those.
Well, I really like that, because, again, stereotypically in a basketball practice, beginning of practice or the end of practice, individual time?
No, always put it in the middle, because you can use it as like a down period or a rest period, you know, and it also means that the player then is using it in the middle of practice as well, you know. So that's why it's so important.
No, I really like that. It makes sense to me, and it comes back to some of the skill acquisition stuff, which is mixing things within practice as well, where they have to come back. And as you said, we want to try to avoid mindless. So we want to get them back. And now, get right back into a situation. And we've got to be able to think and react and all those different things. So
yeah,
really, I like that part of it.
Yeah, and there's so many ways that you can do it. Like, I mean, but that's one way that I, you know, that I found to be the most effective in practice, you know, to be able to make it work in the real world.
Fascinated by some of the things you say, and you know, as we start to move towards the end of this, one of your lessons that you share is there's no such thing as discipline.
So people talk about discipline and they say, oh, you know, we'll enforce discipline, we need to be more disciplined. In truth, particularly nowadays with, you know, the way that society has developed, the only discipline is self-discipline. In other words, I can force you to do something. I can intimidate you. I can bully you. I can, you know, make you scared so that you'll do something. But in reality, today we want kids in the modern sense to take control and to be disciplined themselves so that they'll do it themselves. That's really what the goal is. And that's what we're trying to do. And so the goal should be self-discipline. If you've got a team and you intimidate them and bully them, scare them into doing something, that's not discipline per se. That's, like I say, bullying, fear, whatever. But really, you want to see players who have the discipline to remain emotionally cool, to the discipline not to make certain decisions in certain instances. That's discipline, you know, and so encouraging self-discipline. And the way that you do it is, you know, you outline it, you describe it, and you praise it and encourage it. You really find those things. Because sometimes, you know, yes, a lot of what we do is about identifying a problem and fixing it. But at the same time, we need to take the time to look for the things that players are consciously improving and praise and reinforce them. Because we all want reassurance. We all want to be praised. We all want to feel, fundamentally, we all want to feel necessary. It's a fundamental desire. And the next stage up from that is, you know, being told that we're doing something well and that it's being recognized. So looking for those, you know, those moments where players are being disciplined and, you know, I'm well done. You didn't jump in there. You didn't fall for that. Well done. You held your cool. Or yes, you were provoked. Well done. You know, you held your, like, that's discipline. That's what you're trying to reinforce.
So much great phrasing, I find, when I listen to your stuff or I read some of your stuff. And another one of your interesting phrasings, you can't be half pregnant. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so it's just like, I mean, you have to be completely committed, and it's particularly, for example, around the player experience. And when a player, for example, is taking a shot or they're moving or whatever they're doing, you really, really want the player to be present in the moment, to be fully committed. So you can't, you know, you can't train a player, for example, emotionally, to react to a certain situation if they're not fully engaged in the moment. So you have to be, like, you know, so to speak, fully pregnant. Like, I mean, you have to be fully engaged in the moment and with all of, you know, with drills and everything. Now that means, of course, it's going to be more demanding psychologically. In other words, it's going to be more draining. Players are going to be more tired because they're fully immersed in it. But that equally means then there must be more focus and emphasis on rest and recovery and unwinding. And that's just that balance that you're looking for with players. But it's, yeah, just be aware that you can't go through the motions and expect to improve as a player.
Great to get your quick hit thoughts on these things. Another one, 99% healthy is not 100% injured.
Oh, that's one that really drives me nuts. Yeah, like, I mean, so a player has a small tweak or a small injury and all of a sudden he's on the, you know, reserve list, or he's, you know, lying up on a medical table. No, you might have a small issue, but we can still practice and we can still do something. You know, just because you have one small thing, it doesn't mean, no, I'm, look after the player and you take care of them, you don't do anything that would ever hurt them. But just because you have a small niggle or a small restriction, that does not mean we take you completely out of practice. There might be large portions of practice you can do fully. There might be lots of drills that you can do fully. So we want to keep you as engaged and as close to simmering, as possible, so that then your return to play, your transition back to full engagement, is as short as possible. It's one of the biggest mistakes that's made in rehab, is where a player gets a small injury, we take them completely out of practice, completely away, and then the transition back to the elite level, back to performance, takes so much longer as a result.
Good stuff in that way. And cannot obviously have you leave without giving your perspective on the multi-sport athlete versus specialization. And I think that debate is ongoing and probably will never get solved. But how do you phrase it to parents or coaches that maybe ask you about that a little bit?
Well, I think there are two sides. The side that's spoken about most often is, the multi-sport player, makes a better athlete. And that's true, because I think there's so much specialization in practice with the different sports. So what happens is that we take the player and we only do these types of drills. So the player doesn't develop this robustness as a player in basketball or whatever. And sometimes playing other sports help develop that, even if it's just peripheral vision or proprioception or changing direction or foot movement. So if you're playing soccer, for example, maybe your foot speed, your movement, your ability to change direction and rotate when the ball goes over your head, maybe that particular aspect of in development of a youth player translates and helps develop you better on the court, because you don't do it if you're only playing one sport. And so that's why it happens. But more importantly for me, I think it's the development of the person, the young athlete, being exposed to more teams that have more numbers, different coaches, different coaching styles, maybe traveling more, being put in different situations, playing games and sports where you're not good at, where you have to learn how to take instruction, where you learn to fail and learn from failing. So there's two sides to it. It's not just purely about the athletic development, which is a valid concern and legitimate, but I also think the personal development outside of playing other sports is one that's particularly important. I think that's one that people actually miss completely. They don't take into account. And that helps sustain the person who plays the sport longer than just necessarily, the basketball player, the football player, whatever it is.
Yeah, I like that, because obviously there's two sides to the story, and there's not a simple answer clearly in terms of that. But the other thing, improving your weakness versus doubling down on your strength. What's your view on that? Because again, coaches constantly wrestle with that a little bit about dealing with players.
Yeah, so you have strengths, and that's what you're good at. Now it depends on the stage of development. Like, as a young kid, you want them to continue to develop their strengths and you want them to continue to improve them, but you don't want something to limit their development. And sure, there's some things that players will find more difficult, but the sooner that they can develop them to a point where they are not limiting, where it's not limiting them, then it's not a problem. That's really what you're trying to do. Now, as you develop as a person holistically over time, sometimes strengths can become a weakness, where they become so dominant that is actually preventing you from developing other things, because that's your go-to and you don't actually develop these other things. That's something to be very, very aware of. It's a balance, recognizing that the strength is what got you there. The strength is what defined you. The strength is what makes you unique. You cannot lose that and you need to maintain it, but still recognizing that there are certain limiting factors that you want to ensure they do not hold you back over time.
I imagine it's a similar conversation or similar explanation when we're talking about skill versus conditioning, because I find that a lot of coaches overemphasize conditioning, whereas skill trumps everything to a certain extent, because that leads to confidence, it leads to obviously the impact of the game. Do we over condition somewhat as coaches?
Yeah, my belief is yes. And I think that certain sports, physical qualities are more important, can influence the outcome more. And, like I said, I'm fortunate to work across different sports. When I went to work in soccer, I realized, fit, you can be as fit as you want, but skill is always going to trump. Basketball has a slightly better distribution. Fitness is important, but skill is is very, very important. Soccer is largely skill and tactical based. You can be as fit as you want, but if the other team are tactically astute and very skillful, it doesn't matter. You can run all day. And so recognizing, though, in basketball, for example, that there is a balance. And again, this goes back to what we spoke about earlier. The key is identifying what the problem is correctly. So not looking at the fourth quarter and going, well, we lost the fourth quarter because we were tired. It may not be that. It may have been that in the first quarter, you were running around like headless chickens after the other team because they were just tactically better prepared or they were more skillful. And now you're tired in the fourth quarter as a result of that. You know, the biggest mistake is not coming up with the right solution. It's not identifying what the right problem is in the first place. It doesn't matter how good your solution is if you're solving the wrong problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better in that sense, though. Coach, I cannot thank you enough. Fergus, you've been tremendous. So many wonderful shares through your social media, through your books, et cetera. And I cannot encourage people, if they don't follow you on social media, go follow Fergus, but also go to fergusconley.com. His two books, Game Changer, The Art of Sports Science, and 59 Lessons, they're just tremendous, tremendous resources for coaches that I guarantee, and I don't guarantee much, will stimulate your thinking about what you do. And what I love about so much of it, Fergus, is that there's some real divergent thinking in these books. And that's not to say it's wacky or it's out there or anything like that. It just makes me think and go, okay, why was I doing that? And why am I not doing this type of thing? I assume that was part of your goal in writing the book.
Yeah, and there's so many specialists and some people who do great work and that I've learned from and continue to learn from. And then I always come back to, like all of your listeners, okay, how do I make this all work together? And then how do I make it work at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning when I walk out onto a field or onto a court? And I'm just trying to solve the same problems everybody else has. And then these are just the solutions that I've come up with. And that I'm certainly not saying that my way is the best way and that there aren't people who are doing things as well or better, but this is the best solution that I'm coming up with at this point in time.
Love it. Coach, it's fergusconley.com. Go there, check it out, and follow him on social media as well. And so many good things all the time. So thank you so much, Fergus, for taking the time and spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Thank you.
Coach, it is finally here. Go to www.dougnovakbasketball.com today to get 3 all-access practices, a finishing video, and a full team film session from one of the best basketball educators in the world, Doug Novak of Bethel University. Open the doors and get full access to 3 practices, 1 full unedited film session, and a point of attack instructional finishing video. That's www.dougnovakbasketball.com to learn more, or go to www.bivideoproductions.com to see all the ways we are sharing the game. Enjoy the podcast. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.